Well, it's Friday the 13th. So I thought it would be a good night to talk about dukkha. And really what I have for you is a story mostly, and something that took place at the monastery many years ago that served to be a great teacher at the time and continues to be a great teacher for me on this topic. And it's an evening that revealed a lot of the teaching of the Buddha on this topic. I go to the monasteries a lot. Some of you may know I usually spend a couple of months a year at mostly the English monasteries, but also the one in California in the lineage of Ajahn Chah. And one of the things I love as a laywoman going there is that every Friday evening, except during the time where we're in full retreat, we have what we call, down at the nun's cottage, we have nun's tea. And this is an occasion where, you know, at 5 o'clock every Friday afternoon, we gather together, the local lay women who support the monastery, who live in the area, and any of the visiting lay women who are resident there for the time. And it's a very nice gathering. You know, we have a couple of hours to be together, and it's a very, you know, if you've ever seen some of these English cottages, they can be quite cozy and comfortable, and, you know, especially in the winter, there's a fireplace, and we always have a fire, and, you know, you've got Buddha rupas all around, and all kinds of warm images, and the whole idea of the English and their tea, you know, all of this, it really, I just love it. It's just a wonderful occasion. So what the idea on the part of the nuns is to just create an atmosphere of welcoming and of ease so that we can gather together and bring together our questions about Dhamma. But also what's more often the case is that somebody has some life issue, some concern, whether it's a relationship or a situation or something like this, that one is wanting a Dhamma perspective on, wanting to understand it through the eyes of the Dhamma. And so we come to this gathering with these kinds of concerns. And it's very nice. So sometimes, I mean, it just starts off, it's very newsy, just kind of gathering. Sometimes if you haven't been there for a while, it's always fun to see who you haven't seen. And, you know, we get up to date on marriages and anniversaries and deaths and births and all of this. And so that goes on for a little bit. And I think this is, just as an aside, this is all very important part of our Dhamma practice, you know, where we have Dhamma friends and we build the bonds that bring us together. We build on these things. Our common bond is the love of the Dhamma, love of virtue, love of certain ways of living. And, you know, often when I teach in local communities, I make certain that all of the gatherings include a fair amount of socializing, you know, which came as a shock to one group where they just want to come in and sit, you know. And yet this experience of coming together with people of like mind is so important. And so this, for me, this is one of the places where I get to enjoy this feeling. So the idea from the nuns' perspective was to make themselves available, just to be available to address personal concerns and personal issues and questions about the Dhamma. So for myself, over the years, I just so look forward to these gatherings, and I find them incredibly helpful, not only helpful, but they're very nourishing and nurturing, you know, just because of all of the good feelings that go along with it. And there's a number of gals, English women, who've been attending this for 15 years, you know, every opportunity. Unless they're out of town or something, they come. And so they're quite friendly with each other. And you sort of get to know each other very well. And so this one woman came this particular week. And you could tell as soon as she came in the door that she was just kind of bubbling over with something. You know, there was some concern that, you know, you had that feeling, well, we're going to talk about what's on her mind tonight, you know, because you could see it. It was a tremendous anxiety in her face. And her eyes even bloodshot from crying a lot. And so, sure enough, we sat down, we did our usual passing the tea around, and then when it came time to open the floor, you know, she just jumped right in. It was very clear that she was going to be the one to bring the issue to the table. And to tell you the truth, this was many years ago, and even soon after it, I can't recall the details of the particular issue, but I remember the feeling very well, and I remember some of it. But really, to the best of my recollection, it had to do with a situation at work where somebody who was in a high position of authority was making a lot of decisions that were affecting people in a very painful way, and not including people in decision-making, and just creating a lot of difficulty for them in their lives. And it was causing a tremendous amount of stress on the job for her. But really what was making matters worse, as somebody who's a longtime Buddhist practitioner, she realized that none of the employees were particularly handling it very well. You know, there was it was bad enough, the situation, but then you got all the water cooler talk and the break room talk and the, you know, a lot of gossiping, a lot of backbiting, and a lot of just a very unskillful speech going on. And this was tormenting her, too. You know, just that it's bad enough, you know. But there was faction building and, you know, what I call building your case. You know, everybody's kind of gathering around, well, you know, and saying all the things that they thought they needed to say about this condition. So, as I said, I don't really recall the particular details of the issue, but I do recall the feeling. And it was a very strong feeling of powerlessness and helplessness, you know, not being at in any kind of control over a situation, and nobody seemed to be handling it very well on top of that. So she brought this hoping that the nuns and the other lay women would be able to offer some skillful ways of dealing with it. You know, when things like this are going on, there's a spinning, isn't there? You know, the mind just won't let it go. It just keeps spinning and spinning and spinning until you feel like you're getting pulled down into a vortex. And it can so dominate our lives when there's some dukkha that we haven't fully embraced or haven't worked with thoroughly. So, I mean, just the upshot of it was that she was just in tremendous distress. And she talked about how she tried this, how she tried that. And one could see that she was very nervous and she felt very alone and helpless. So, after she put it all on the table, it was interesting to see our initial response, you know, 10 or 12 women who really care about her. And, you know, could feel the distress. What do we do with dukkha? What do we do with it, you know? And it was interesting to watch how the first line of response was this frenzied parade of suggestions of what you can do to fix it, you know, what you can do to make it not be the way that it is. And even in our response to it, we were all quite frenzied, you know. So somebody said, well, perhaps you're not alone in all of this. You know, have you found any allies? There's got to be somebody in this who feels the way that you feel. And, you know, and somebody else said, you know, well, go over their head, you know. Don't they have a boss? You can deal with their boss, you know. And somebody else said, well, what about grievance procedures? You know, talk to the board of directors. If you don't have a grievance procedure, it's time to get one. And we've got to deal with all this. You know, people can't treat each other like this. You know, it's terrible. And then at one point, somebody said, you know, we should form a committee. And at that point, we all burst out laughing, you know. It was like, once you get to the point where you form a committee, you know you're going down the wrong path, you know. So we had lots of good ideas. But as these things go, you could feel it every time. You know, we would put it out and process it a little bit, put out the next one, process it a little bit, and every one of them had problems with them. You know, you could feel that we weren't nailing it. We weren't getting at this remedy, this way of fixing it, this way of changing the situation. And so after a long silence, it was really interesting. You know, we finally exhausted everything and just sat there in silence for a while. And in a way, in our own way, I think each of us just kind of feeling it. And then out of the silence, somebody said, "Well, this is it, isn't it? This is dukkha. This is what the Buddha's talking about. This is the first noble truth." It was such a simple remark. But it was like, after you've exhausted all the other approaches, now you're ready to get to the truth. You know, this is dukkha. And we quoted the first noble truth, or part of it. Certainly not the full picture of dukkha. But this bit that says we have to associate with things we don't like, be separated from things that we like, and not get what we want. You know, this is part of the Buddha's definition of dukkha. And the statement in this teaching on the noble truth is that this is the way it is. And with that, it was a very powerful experience for all of us. With that, it was like you could feel the energy in the room just completely drop. It was like this feeling that what I often have when I imagine myself like getting into an elevator and going down a few floors. You know, oof, now we've gotten completely out of the head. We've lost all this heady response to it, and we're getting to where we can actually address this concern. We're getting it down into the heart, out of the cerebral place, and into the feeling place, where things get real. You know, things get authentic, finally. And it was very, very tangible feeling. And so I think this is a lot about, a lot of what the Buddha is pointing to in this teaching, that day after day, we're bumping up against dukkha in one form or another, and things that we don't like, having to be separated from things we like, not getting what we want, all of this. And not seeing this truth, what happens is the unawakened mind, you know, the mind that hasn't seen through or penetrated these realities, it just it picks up the experience and scrambles. You can see you can feel these mad frenzies in the mind as it endeavors to fix it, to make it not be the way that it is, to make it be, to try to bring it around to some other way. And that's where we live a lot of the time, just in that scramble of trying to force resolution. And so in this first noble truth, I think the Buddha is saying that, you know, far from fixing things, this movement of the mind is actually getting us deeper in. You know, it's compounding the problem. Because now you not only have the conditions of life that are, by their definition, difficult, but now the way that we're coping with it is to add a whole other layer of difficulty. And so the whole system contracts about around something that, in plain and simply, and this is not a cold and callous response, but very simply is the way it is. This is the way it is right now. And you can take this crosstown bus, you know, in our response to that. So in this teaching, I think it's as if the Buddha is inviting us to just turn around and face that, because everything in us, I mean, really, at a very reptilian core of our being, you know, and understandably is trying desperately for this to make this reality not be our reality, going bonkers, trying to make it not be this way. So open to the conditions of our lives, open to the people in our lives, open to the situations in our lives, and we open to these truths. So, you know, in the room that night, that's where we went. And you could feel the tears forming, especially this woman. Now, she was an English woman, and English women don't wail. But she did. It was the closest thing I've ever heard to that, coming from an English woman, you know, and it just really let it rip, just really got down into the feeling of how much this situation hurt. And she, you know, she moaned and let out this whole string of epithets. You know, it's like, it hurts, it stinks, I can't stand this, this is awful, this is terrible, this is so, you know, how can people be so hateful? How can people be so insensitive? You know, all of this kind of, just getting it out. This is what's going on. This is what she was actually feeling. And it was really a very powerful moment for all of us, many of us in synchronicity. We're going to the same place. And what happens in that place where you're finally saying it? You know, I mean, for myself, I had many occasions where I would turn to what I call remedial metta, you know, to try not to feel it. You got to be careful with metta, because when you're suffering, you know, or angry with somebody for the pain that they're causing you, then the tendency is to pick up some of these practices that, yeah, have very good intention to try to get us to a more loving place. But sometimes, you know, we go to, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be free, you know, and all it is this, you know. I don't want to feel this. I don't want to feel this, you know. And so in many respects, the response that she was making at this time, I hate this, was much more authentic, much more real, and much more likely to get her to a place of metta than sort of the overlay. And when we touch this, I think it's been interesting to me in my own life and practice to see how this the touching of dukkha at this level is wisdom, it's truth, and how when that happens, the constant companion of wisdom, it's like the flip side of the coin, is compassion. You know, when you get it, the only thing that makes sense, given the truth of dukkha, is to comfort, to bring comfort and compassion to the pain. And that's what we found ourselves doing, you know. And it was like the truth is that people treat each other badly. The truth is that, you know, we all kind of stumble around life trying to do the best we can as incredible intentions, wonderful intentions. And even with the best of intentions, we're going to jab the heck out of each other, you know. And it hit me one time that, you know, sometimes you're the jabber, and sometimes you're the jabby, you know. And that's the way it is. That's the way it goes. And to the extent that we can get that, then we can live together in harmony that much better. So, you know, knowing this, it's how we can hurt each other. It's part of why we have the precepts. You know, they're there to offset some of the harm. You know, and it cut down some of the pain that we cause to one another. But in a way, I think what the Buddha's saying here is that it's always going to be this way. You know, at least as long as we're still caught in samsara, it's going to be this way. And we have to get that. We have to get that there is dukkha and open the heart to the full experience of it. Just learn to relax and receive and accept the conditions of our lives. This is one of the conditions of our lives. And it's weird, but sometimes I find with difficulties in my life that's almost all you need to do. Just take the jab. You know, just, wow. Come and sit back up, you know, take another jab. Sit back up. You know, I felt that one time I was feeling like that. You know those little punching bags we used to have when we were a kid? You punch them and they come back up. You punch them and they come back up. They're like 3 or 4 feet tall. Did you ever see those? That's what I feel like being a human being is, you know. Just, you know, take the jab, come back up. Take the jab, come back up. And it's like that, one after another. And it can sound like a dismal teaching, but the weird thing is that as we get this, then what happens is that it's like you sort of, you feel it. You cry, you punch a wall. You know, I punch walls. Just feel it, get it out. You know, that's what it feels like. And let it be the way it is. You know, from this vantage point, things start to look very different once we can touch that. So for me, it took many years of practice, really, many years into practice before it started to hit me that insight into dukkha wasn't going to be fun. It wasn't going to feel good, you know, that. But that it was imperative. And over time, you begin to see that opening to the difficulties of life and really feeling the pain of life is actually far less painful than living life with all the resisting and the wanting and the contracting around it and the demanding that it be different than it is. There's something that when the heart opens, it's almost like the whole body opens, the whole human organism becomes a receiver, a receptor, and it's willing to take the conditions of our lives. And so insight into dukkha just cuts through just a huge reactive layer of trying to get free of difficulty. It's a hard reality, I think. But what the Buddha's pointing to here is that there isn't any getting free of it. It's the way it is, at least not in the short term, and at least not as long as the mind remains in its unawakened state. And so when we get that, then you find that there's just a new kind of freedom in our experience. There's the freedom to open and receive whatever life has to offer. You find that we can cope. We can deal with it. It's not as horrible as it is, as I said, when we're fighting and resisting and tightening around it. This is a major shift in our way of being, insight into dukkha. It's a major shift. Because suddenly, things that were always put outside of life become normal. Yeah, this is normal. So at Nun's Tea, we hit this place and sat there again in a long silence, and we were just kind of all soaking in this understanding that proceeded from our discussion of the topic. But then it was interesting because, you know, you start to get these, well, yeah, but, you know, these kind of obvious questions start to rise. You know, you sort of half get the truth of dukkha or half get what the Buddha is saying in this. And for us, the obvious questions were, well, yeah, but what do we do about this jerk? You know, isn't there something that we can do about this guy and this situation and the fact that all these people are suffering? You know, is the Buddha saying, don't do anything? Just accept it. These are the conditions of your life. Receive it. And your problems will be over, you know. Or like Ajahn Sumedho says, you know, is the Buddha saying, life is miserable, wake up and be miserable, you know? Is he saying just to accept it, to play dead, to roll over, to become a doormat? You know, because it can sound like that, can't it? If you only work with this part of the way. But this is where I think the subtlety of the teaching begins to reveal itself. Because I don't know, to me, it's as if the Buddha is saying, in a way, you know, he's not going to get involved in those kinds of details. You know, that's not the essence of this teaching in particular. There are other teachings. There's a lot in the body of the Buddhist teachings where that have to do with behaving skillfully so that we don't do harm. Or there's a whole lot in the teachings about handling disputes and how does one do that when there's difficulty in the community, in the Sangha. And so it's not that that's not there. But here, I think, in the Noble Truths, what he's trying to get at is that stop the wanting. Stop the movement of the mind that is compounding this condition of human existence. At least at one level. I mean, the Noble Truths, you can take this quite deep, actually. It's basically, at its core, saying stop the craving so that you won't be reborn, so that you don't have to keep coming back into this human life, because this is the way it is in the human realm. So, but here, I think what he's saying is just to stop the wanting it to be another way and just touch this truth, even when it's difficult, especially when life is difficult, that it's not, and this movement is not going to change the conditions of our lives, but it is going to change dramatically the way that we're with them. And the heart stops that resisting, stops that longing, just really uprooting the response of greed, hatred, and delusion in relation to the conditions of our lives. So, and ironically, at least what I've seen over the years, is that opening to this truth of dukkha can help us to see if a situation is untenable. You know, and sometimes they are. Sometimes the harm that's being done in a situation or a condition is so great that we the wise course is to leave it, to move away from it. You know, but it's almost as if you can't do that as long as there's fighting and resisting, because we haven't turned around and faced the monster. We haven't turned and touched it yet. The mind is still scrambling and trying to make the condition not be the way that it is. And so if you can feel that, as long as it's trying to do that, we haven't gotten to the baseline yet. We haven't cleared it out to where the heart has fully received the condition. And it's at that point that we begin to get clear. What came to mind when I was thinking about this earlier is that a situation where years ago I used to work in my previous incarnation, one of my positions was with the Commission on the Status of Women in a small community in North Carolina. And this was many years ago when there was a kind of a social movement, really, to address this issue of battered wives, battered women. And it's far back enough that now they're kind of second place, but happening in most communities. But then, this was a revolutionary new idea. Battered spousal abuse was just coming out of the closet, basically. And local communities were finally standing up and saying, we need to address this as an issue in our community. And so it fell on me and my colleagues to start a shelter, basically, start a battered women's shelter. And it was interesting to me because it was new enough as an issue, and people were unfamiliar with it enough, unless, of course, they were experiencing it themselves, to not understand it completely. And one of the questions that we would get often as we were going around speaking and trying to stir up some interest in it was, why do women stay? Why do they stay in such a difficult situation? You know, and certainly there's many reasons, and one doesn't want to reduce the reasons or diminish them in any way. It's a very complex issue. But one of the things that my colleagues and I noticed as we worked with it through the years was that a key common denominator, a key ingredient to transformation for the women was when they could get to the place of actually acknowledging that it was happening. They have very complex mental states of explaining it away, denying it, talking about how he doesn't mean it, and all of which, and there's some beautiful energy in all of that, you know, that it's not all unskillful, but the point was that they and it wasn't until they could get to this point where they went, ah, I'm being hurt, you know, that they actually would begin the movement towards change. And there was a surrender, if you will, that let the pain in and let the resistance out, that wonderful Tonglin kind of practice, you know, where you just let it in and stop resisting it. And you get to this first line of response, this baseline of response, which has to be to open the heart to the truth of dukkha and feel it and let it be. Let it be what it is. Not that you hold it there, and not that you stop there, but that this is a key player in this process. So it's as if, to me, the Buddha is saying that you can't address concerns. You can't deal with the situation until you've dealt with your own pain. You know, I've certainly seen this to be true in my life, and I was thinking about a relationship, a long-time relationship that I have, a very dear friend, very wonderful friend, and over 20 years or so. But one of the, in the early years of this relationship, there was something that he would do that always felt like a jab. You know, whatever we would be talking about something, we'd be exchanging something, and then somehow the energy would turn and I'd get a jab, you know. And it's maybe just be how it felt to me, but it was just that kind of, you know, I'm sure you've met people that have just little personality quirks, that they, well-intentioned, beautiful people, they don't know that they're doing things that are hurting other people, you know. And so I would just watch. I've just watched over the years the process that I've gone through in trying to be with this and address it. And at first, definitely for many years, I so wanted this person in my life that I would explain it away. You know, you know, it's okay. They don't mean it. Da da da. And then, but then at some point, you know, when you take enough jabs, you know, you've got to go, this hurts, you know? And so then finally, when I would start to feel it, then one of the first reactions was to hate it and to hate him and to push him out, you know? I went through this period of a couple of years of just totally rejecting him. Get out of my life. Don't want anything to do with you, you know? It's kind of like I relate it to kind of what I call my adolescent mind, you know. It was, I don't like you. You're hurting me. I don't want you in my life, like I used to do when I was 16. And you could do that when you're 16. You know, get out of my life. But then just watching it, but all the time still continuing to work with it, continuing to try to see what my pain is in this situation. You know, what's the pain of that jab, and trying to understand how it is that I'm not receiving this condition, and what in my own projections and everything is a player in any of this. And so gradually over the years, it's been very interesting. It took, you know, 15 years really to get to the point where one could accept the dukkha of it. You know, it's like I could say, well, oh God, he's a guy. Guys are insensitive, you know, all that kind of stuff. But eventually to just say, this is the way he is. You know, this is the way it is. It feels like this. And I have to say that it's not until I got to that point, which was a way of receiving the pain of it, receiving what I was feeling in all of this, that I could actually talk to him about it. Some of these things take 15, 20 years. Some of them take lifetimes. Some of them take more than that. But just having gone through this process, and this is just one example in my life, that one can really see very directly how effective it is, how much more rich it is when we actually receive the harm ourselves. And let that be the baseline. Get over resisting, contracting, pushing away the pain, but just let it in, that this thing you do is hurting me. That and then it becomes very matter of fact. Now I can talk about it. You know? It's very, very powerful. And once we open the heart to dukkha, then we can address concerns with much greater clarity, with much greater wisdom. And I mean, one of the prime examples of this is Gandhi. I can remember when that Richard Attenborough movie came out with about Gandhi many years ago, and I loved it so much. I bought it, and I remember just playing it over and over again. I think I played it 14 or 16 times and just watched it. And there was something so moving about his life and how it was represented there. But one of the things that really stood out in it was this this period that he went through where he sort of went on a pilgrimage through his country. He got on the trains and he went to every nook and cranny of India that he could. And basically, the upshot of that trip was, of that pilgrimage, was to listen, to receive the pain of his countrymen, the pain that they felt in this oppressive state. And very powerful, the powerful effect that it had on him was like it took all of that, took that listening and receiving the pain for him to get clear on what it was that he needed to do. You know, at least as I understand it. You know, some of you may know his life better than I do, but that's the way it looked. And it was like on the heels of that, that's when he came back and basically said to the British, "This isn't working. You're going to have to leave our country. You know, the way that you're behaving is hurting us." It's like he got it, you know. It went in. He took the jab, felt it, and inhaled it, processed it, and came out the other side with that kind of clarity. And so clear that, I mean, I don't want to oversimplify, but, you know, the British left. It was amazing. So it's all a lot more clear when we touch the dukkha first. And that's what I think this is the upshot of what the Buddha is trying to get at here. You know, with this First Noble Truth, I think he's trying to help us to certainly relieve some of the stress of our lives. You know, the stress of resisting and wanting things to be different. But he's also offering a wake-up call, I think. It's as if he's trying to get us to acknowledge or admit that life contains this. This is not outside of life. You know, dukkha is not outside of it. But in the process of opening to it, we awaken to what is really a bias in the unawakened mind. There's a bias towards pleasure. You know, when everything's going the way we want it, when we're getting what we want, when nobody's misbehaving, it's right. And when we have to associate with things we don't like, be separated from things we like, and not get what we want, that's wrong. And he's saying, that's not true. That's not the way it is. They're both the way it is. And we have to open and receive that there is difficulty in our experience as human beings. And opening to that, admittedly, can be very painful. But at least it's been my experience that initial pain of opening to it is so worth it. Because it's temporary in a way, you know, and as we get it, that life contains these experiences. then you sort of accept it. And this whole layer of at least the psychological suffering that comes from resisting is removed. And you open into what are really the normal conditions of our lives. So, and accept these. So, I mean, you know, you can think that what we're saying here is that, and then it's all going to be nice and great. But that, I don't think that's what he's saying either. You know, it's not that it's suddenly going to be wonderful because you've accepted that it's not. It's kind of an oxymoron. You know, it's just that when the jabs occur, they aren't received with this contraction and resistance and rejection, as if somehow it doesn't belong in life. It is life. It's part of it. And it's very liberating to open to this. Even death can be received in this whole approach to it. You know, Ajahn Chah would say that those who don't understand the fact of death, for those who don't understand that, life is very confusing. I really like that. You know, we don't relax and don't settle into the experience of dukkha. So the subtlety, I think, of this teaching just rests in the fact that it points to a fundamental truth that is like right in front of us. It's so part of our experience every day. I mean, have you had any dukkha today? It is so there and so resisted and rejected. And we live in the resistance and the rejection. We live in that frenzy of reaction to it. And he's saying, drop down and get into the actual experience of it. Embrace this fundamental truth. And he's not saying that life is suffering, as it's often misquoted, and so just wake up and be miserable. He's not saying that. He's rather just saying, well, wake up and see this fundamental truth of our experience and be free. You know, they don't call it liberation for nothing. There's a freedom in this kind of opening. So sometimes the process of getting to this truth is very, very powerful and very, very painful. And sometimes it can be something that you work with over a period of 20, 30, 40 years, particular situations, people, conditions of our lives. But the idea, I think, here is that if we just hang in there and keep bearing it and opening and trying to come to some understanding about this simple reality, then that the payoff is definitely worth it. And certainly, I mean, for myself, I'm certainly not there myself, but what you find over the years, just like that example with my good friend that I've worked with, that way that he jabs me, you know, you just get glimpses. You get little mini insights into how this truth is the way that it is. And those build to a critical mass, I think, eventually. And then the heart just gets it. This is the first noble truth. There is dukkha. It can sound so gloomy. And it's so liberating. So I offer you this for your reflection tonight. Shall we sit for just a moment with? So shall we close with the reflection on the sharing of blessings?
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.